three questions here. One of them, the first one, is quite an important one. Is there any special breathing method in connection with the exercise given last week? We'll deal with that one first. When you are breathing, you do not suck air into the lungs from the air. You do not take the energy from the air, but you have energy inside you which has imposed itself on the breathing apparatus. So that the rhythm of your breathing is evidence of an energy being used. And if you try to hold your breath, stop breathing altogether, you will find a peculiar imperativeness in the breathing center. So if you, with your conscious mind, try to inhibit breathing, you will discover that there is another level of being which you are not normally conscious, but which insists on breathing. So we'd be better to make sure about that now. It won't take long. I don't think it'll take longer than a couple of minutes for the best of us. Let's all hold our breath. Just breathe in, hold your breath, and try, to the best of your ability, not to breathe again, and in process, watch in your body where the impulse to breathe starts from. All take a breath, hold it, and be determined that you are not going to release it. And then watch in your body while you're holding your breath to see where the imperative to breathe comes from. What center did you find?
Something there in the abdomen. There's a tightness across here.
Yeah, you all agree that it's somewhere near here, don't you?
Yes, in abdomen stuff too.
Now, there is a center there where energy is coming in. And your conscious mind has a job to defeat it. It is actually possible, if you're really obstinate about it, to deprive yourself of oxygen and faint. Some of the Everest men did it as an exercise. But when you do so, it starts up again. So even when you are unconscious, it carries on. And when you try with your consciousness to fight it, it's a very, very hard fight. And it's centered somewhere here. Now that shows you that there is a non-individuated energy, that it is not connected necessarily with that part of your being which you conceptualize as yourself. So there is a breathing rhythm in us which is deeper, more imperative than the conscious individuality of an ordinary man. He can be defeated by a man if he integrates himself to a high degree. But when he has defeated it and fallen unconscious, then it starts up again. It shows again that it is a separate sense of being. Now, we often hear references in mystical literature to a kind of breathing called soul breathing. Breathing with the soul instead of breathing with the atmospheric air. And this breathing is connected with the magical process that we were discussing last week. If you find the center in your physical body where the breathing imperative manifests, and you deliberately cut it down to the minimum, at a certain level of repression of this, you will find a tendency to imagine a breathing process going on. You believe you are imagining it, which in actual physical fact is not going on. In other words, your imaginative breathing is deeper than your physical breathing. Now this breathing if it is truly imaginative, in our sense that the marg in imaginative means the will, is what we want to get at, because it affects the whole psyche. Now, the breath rate of an average person is fairly rapid and varies a lot according to the emotional condition. But the breath rate to be aimed at is that physical rate of breathing which corresponds exactly with the proper rate of the soul breathing. We know, and if we take the three-part man, somewhere over there, coming in is the imperative of breathing. We know that there is an energy which is contracting here and then expanding again, somewhere centered there. And that this energy is a field state. It is actually an expansion and a contraction of a field energy, which is the cause of the motion of the lungs. The air doesn't move the lungs, but the lungs are moved by this force, and the result is that the air enters the lungs. So if we try to inhibit breathing, we'll really try to control this field. And when we define the exercise of inhibiting breathing, in the fact of defining it, we come up here. We have a concept of breathing and a concept of interference. When we try to impose on this center, which is connected with our life, with the thinking center, which is derived from the five sense percepts, adding up into a concept of individuality, to try to break this rhythm is to call upon energies here which are not normally resident in a man. We have to file in energies into our conceptual structure to a very high degree before we can actually hold the breath even for more than a couple of minutes. To extend your held breath to 3 minutes, to 3.5, to 4, requires a terrific amount of integration in there, because you have to impose a concept on a fundamental impulse. If we get used to this feeling of breathing, its imperativeness, and watch it compared with the concept, and then bring the conceptual rate of breathing in line with the psychic breathing, we can then discover that if that represents an individual, and this represents the macrocosmic sphere outside it, we can bring the individual into phase with the solar rhythm. So we have a means of bringing ourselves into phase, into harmony with solar rhythms through the breathing center. And in general, we can say that the breath rate is slower there than the average man will breathe. So if we count the average breath, let's count our own. Just mentally breathe in and out, as usual, and count in terms of seconds. Count one and two and put an and in between, and then you won't skip that. One and two and one. And see how many you breathe in and out. Two in and three out is not a bad rhythm for average function. But now, do it again, but this time watch your emotional condition. Just do that for 30 seconds, breathing it in and two out.
I find that felt it might be when it was changing, I was thinking about it rather.
Yes, well, you would start interfering with it unconsciously. And just deliberately now, breathe in 2 seconds and out 2 seconds, and watch your feeling. Now change the rate to 4 in and 4 out, and watch the difference in your feeling level. Tighten up a bit. Let's use another word for it. You've got a sense that you are controlling it.
You're making an effort.
You're making an effort.
Constriction.
That effort is controlling. The constriction, deliberately done, is control. Now your emotional state, when you breathe slowly in that way, if you hold it, puts you in contact with volition. If you allow your breathing to go, it will vary according to the ideas flying through your mind, which induce emotional states which affect the breathing and make it variable. If you want to stabilize your emotions, you deliberately regularize your breathing. And you'll notice a very peculiar thing about it, that if you breathe slowly, 4 in and 4 out, you will feel your temperature rising. Did anybody notice that? Now, why is that? Because you'd expect the opposite to happen, wouldn't you? You think if you breathe more, that your temperature would become higher, wouldn't you? Yet, in fact, what you feel is yourself getting warm when you breathe slower. Why is that?
You're doing more muscular work holding it.
You're doing more muscular work holding it. Now, that work is introverted work. And you are curving energies back on yourself in so doing. Now you might have heard of a famous Irish hero who, when he fought, got so hot that there was a great aura of heat round him, and he glowed with horrible heat and terrified his enemies. Now this is very, very similar to the kind of breathing we're talking about. In his day it was customary for men called heroes deliberately to make the breathing very, very slow, because the amount of energy held in to make it slow heats the body up to such a pitch that it can strike very much more strongly than in ordinary shallow breathing. Now let's remember, if we take a diagram of the solar system and the diameters of it, which would represent ideally as a simple circle without any distortions. In the actual solar system there's a long axis and a short, but we can calculate the variation between the long one and the short from the distortions on the circle, and say that there is a rhythm running through here as we go around the solar system on the Earth, and a subdivision of this impulse down to a certain limit constitutes an in-breath and an out-breath for a human being. Now, in the solar system, that is practically a constant. There is a solar rhythm. If we allow ourselves to become excited by external stimuli, the rhythm that we get is imposed on us by accident. That is, by no necessity of inner being. So if you suddenly shout at a child and make the child jump, you have imposed on it an accidental rhythm, a rhythm non-essential to the child. If all accidental rhythms are removed, then your breath rate will be a partial, a harmonic, of the solar rhythm. And if it is such a partial, then you'll become progressively more and more conscious of the solar being. Now, it's resident in its center, in that group of nerves, cluster, that we call the solar plexus. It's here that this imperative flows through. Not to the structure as a gross material structure, but to the subtle structure which corresponds to it. So if we find that solar rhythm in ourselves, which we do by slowing our breathing down till it has become volitional, we can, by increasing sensitivity, find a rhythm in us which corresponds exactly with the solar rhythm. Then we must be fed by solar energy. And it is our aim to become solar in rhythm rather than lunar. The moon rhythms vary much more than the solar rhythms. And if we go on the lunar rhythms, we will be more subject to variation in our psychic processes. Hence we're not by the inconstant moon. So we have to aim at a kind of breathing which will put us in contact with the solar breathing. Behind the solar breathing there is a sidereal breathing, and behind that the breathing of the absolute. And it is a definite process of breathing, just as much as this physical intake of air. There is an intake into the macrocosmos of energy and an expulsion of that energy from it. Just in the same way, say, a certain kind of jellyfish in the sea expands and water goes in and contracts and water goes out. There is a rhythm there. So every being, from the macrocosmic being downwards, has a peculiar rhythm to do with energy intake and energy expenditure. And therefore, there is a proper cosmic rhythm. If we find that rhythm in ourselves, a harmonic of the solar rhythm, of the sidereal rhythm, of the absolute, then we are finding that in us which will harmonize the whole being. Because the essential of unity is that there must be a proper place for each partial activity within us. It's this harmonic process which is going to harmonize the body. I believe that Mr. Watson is going to bring his bass down next week when he will show you what harmonics are and their relations. When you get used to the idea that there is a proper breathing for you when you are in a calm state, and that the restatement of that breathing will always restate the condition of the psyche in calmness, then you will deliberately cultivate that breathing alone which can give you the condition you want. Because if you allow shallow, irregular breathing, you cannot control yourself. Hence the importance in yoga of breathing exercises. Now in yoga they have a ratio of 1:4 and 2 for breathing. If you inhale 1 unit, you hold 4 and exhale 2. So if you inhale 4, 16, 8 in seconds. You keep that ratio, and that ratio forces you to become volitional. It isn't a ratio that you can do accidentally. So it is really calling upon your volitional center when you keep to that ratio, hence the great stress upon it. You cannot make that ratio accidentally. It forces you onto your volitional center. And if you become progressively more aware of the center where the breathing impulse comes in, when you are applying that ratio, at a certain point you will feel that the thing is fighting, the rhythm is fighting all that you call your individual tendencies. If it wins, you have gained your end. If that rhythm dominates the individual one, you have gained your harmony. If the individual one destroys that ratio, then you will lapse into individual perturbability. So remember that 1:4:2 ratio, because it's very important, because it forces you onto a volitional level. So you can see if you were to step that up to 16, this becomes quite big. It doesn't matter in advanced breathing exercises how long you try to do it, if you keep that ratio. If you keep the ratio with only 1 second in, 4 held and 2 out, it will still force you onto the volitional center. It is not an exercise you can do unconsciously. Now, in ordinary breathing exercises, you can breathe in and out and in and out and forget you're doing it. So it is not necessarily a volitional exercise. And all the exercises to do with magical development have to be volitional. So a device that forces you onto your volitional centre is needed in the initial stages. And this ratio is such a device. It affects the body in a peculiar way and cannot be done accidentally. So about the breathing, we will say that every centre you have is breathing at a certain rate. So this lower one here, in taking energy in and then letting energy out, has a rhythm which could be called breathing. It is intaking and exhaling. The same thing with the lungs and the same thing with the head. This rhythm of waking and sleeping has to do with certain centres up here, and centre here and here harmonise with it. So of breathing, we have to find our proper centre, deliberately interfere with it so that we can locate it by its reaction, and then stabilise the rhythms of it so that we can discover the cellular rhythm. And first of all, use a very, very simple one, four in and four out, and hold it, four in and four out, in order to make sure that you know where that centre is. When you have it perfectly clear in your mind, then go on to the 1-4-2 ratio and hold it and test yourself. Now, whatever phenomena should appear in your mind, they themselves are not magical. But when you get onto the level of the field change, you will experience something totally different. If you don't ignore the first manifestations, like occasional flashes, if you don't ignore those, then you will not get onto a higher level, because you'll become delighted and involved with what in effect is really a physiological manifestation. I think that's enough about the breathing for the time being. There's a question here about the ancient mystery schools such as Pythagoras and so on. Could it be said that they were magical schools in the sense we understand it? We can say that all the ancient mystery schools were magical in the sense we defined last week. We will take the word mystery now and show the relation between this and magic. This first letter, the Greek letter for it is really pronounced U, and has to do with the letter for urge and the letter for precision simultaneously. Here is the Torah again. Here is the issue. So the substantial, urge point, that's urge point, issue, producing the Tor-Ter earth integration. Now compare that with the magical process, then this becomes the G, and the integration is the IK. The law integration by means of the issue of the substantial urge form. So the mysteries were actually ritual processes for inducing levels of consciousness not accessible to the ordinary five sense mind. And remember, we mentioned the exaltation of the will, that you have to lift the will up deliberately by using the will on itself. You must elevate it by a process of internal self-exciting. This is called the exaltation of the will. The will has to be lifted up into a state of enthusiasm. Now, enthusiasm itself is a word that means God has come into me. The enthusiasm means that in the God, this function has substantialized itself. So to be enthusiastic is actually to be working in the manner of a divine being. Now the difference between an average person and a divine person is enthusiasm. But let's say the average man has enthusiasm for nothing. He has nothing in himself that works continuously towards an end. A stimulus from outside produces a reaction. But he has no principle inside himself of continuous application. So he's not enthusiastic. He has no divine impulse in him. So when we're talking about the mysteries, we are talking about those processes into which men were initiated, processes of the law, which understood led to the integration of a man, when he applied unto his own substantial urge and form these principles, and working upon himself for this initiation. So that if we say the old form, the mu and the me are telescoped together, this is the substantial urge, this is substantial form, and both of these result in an issue. That issue is illumination. And it depends on the exaltation of the will. Now there are two aspects here, the urge and the form in the urge. To exalt the will, you have to take the urge and apply it to the form. And you must clarify the form with the power of the urge. You must will that the thing be important. And then with your will, you must penetrate into the thing to make it important. It's an entire act of will. There need not be any importance in the thing itself to begin with. You are going to import into it. Remember, importance means in carried. Import, in carry. There are no importances in the universe other than those things into which man imports his will. So whatever you have defined as important in your life is merely defined as that into which you have willed. So all the different importances of different people are simply the different directions of their will. So we have to take an idea. Let us take the idea of the identity of the individual with the universal. There's the individual and there's the universal. We are going to assert that this is identical with that. And we're going to do it magically. So we say we've drawn a tiny little circle there with a little hole in it, because we remember the rotating force cannot go to the dead centre because it would stop. So it goes near to it and then flies out again to the limit and back again, continuously. So the inner circle that looks like a dot is really a little circle. It is identical with this one in the sense that it has exactly the same form. It's centred, it is co-centric with it, it is not eccentric. It has a common centre. And the rhythm of the one and of the other is correspondent. So we have defined it that this is the large perimeter, the macrocosmos. That's the little perimeter of my being. The form of it is what my eye sees, and now I put my will into it. I now will that this little being, this little circle, shall breathe as from the macrocosmic level. Now if I deliberately do this, I will induce in myself a very rapid increase in temperature. And that increase in temperature purges the body. It's actually like a process of detoxication to do it. The farther out I think that macrocosmic circle is, the slower my breathing will become. Now actually do this as an exercise now. Take your own physical bodies as represented by that little circle, and let this other circle represent the walls of the room to begin with. And just breathe out to the walls of the room and then back again. Out to the walls of the room and back again. Do that for a few seconds. And notice the level of your attention and the amount of will you need to do it. Now compare that with this other one. You now have an idea of Liverpool in your mind. Now breathe to the limits of Liverpool and back again. and notice a change in your feeling content. You got the feeling of Liverpool compared with the first one. Now extend the breathing to cover the whole of Great Britain. Deliberately take the breathing as far as it takes you and as long as it takes you in time to imagine the extent of Britain. Breathe out that far and then back again. When you've got that feeling, now breathe out to include the whole terrestrial globe and back again. Notice the qualitative change in your feeling. Now breathe out beyond the terrestrial globe to the limits of the solar system. In again. Notice the feeling and then change that into breathing right out to the limits of the sidereal system, the farthest stars, in a big sphere around you. We all felt the difference in feeling between those levels and the different rate of the breathing. Did you notice what it was?
Progressively deeper.
Progressively deeper. Now, this is tremendously important because when you conceptualize a thing like this, and deliberately import your will into it, and your will into the imagination, so that as you are extending your spatial concept, your rhythm is becoming slower and deeper. So you are bringing yourself into phase with these other rhythms, solar and sidereal. Now try this little experiment. I want you to imagine the sidereal sphere, and to get to it, I want you to imagine the room. Liverpool will skip Great Britain, go straight to the globe and the solar system and back again, and try to force the transition into 1 second, both ways, and see what happens to you. You've got to get the imagination to fly to all those spaces and back again in 1 second, see what happens. Find that. Can you get confused?
Gravitation.
Did anybody not get confused? See? Now this tells you a peculiar thing about yourself. It actually takes time to imagine spatial distances. So if you take a long distance, like the distance from here to one of the outer stars, it will take you a definite time to get there and back in your imagination. And if you deliberately regulate the breathing to this imagination, you have a mode of magical harmonizing with their correspondent mean levels. Now you'll notice that if you deliberately breathe, I want you all now to, you'll have to do this privately, imagine some emotional situation that you have not liked in the past in relation to some specific situation, very small. Watch your breathing rate while you're doing it. Deliberately selected. Something as unpleasant as you can find in a smaller situation as you can find. And watch your breathing. When you've found it, suddenly shift your imagination right to the terrestrial, the solar, to the sidereal, and feel the change that occurs. Now imagine that sidereal sphere way beyond the limits of the solar sphere. Put your mind in it and breathe at the rate that you have to breathe for that. And then try if you can see any importance in that previous unpleasant situation. Whilst you are at the same time breathing the very slow breath that belongs to the sidereal sphere. See if you can actually do it. If you do this properly, you'll have the key to the effects of identification. What do you find?
Something very distant, difficult to get hold of it, looking down.
Actually, you find that it's practically impossible to do both at once, don't you? So that you cannot actually worry and feel about that particular if you're breathing at this cosmic rate. Now let's say identification, we've said it, it, and that's the entity. Wouldn't I find that fun? This is the fact that we're doing identification, if you like. It, entity. See, which means it, that's it. When you pin yourself on anything, whatever, then the eye has teeth. That is, it has become a mechanical proposition. Those are the teeth on the cogwheel. There is the eye, the observer. When the observer conceptualizes itself as fitting into a situation, just like one cog, a nice piece of cogwork, that's the, fits into another one. So identification is the observer with tooth concept, fitting into something. The identification, the entity, is made into an it, that is an object, material, by the fact of identification. Now whatever form, the e, me, you set up and identify with, there is a corresponding u, or urge, level for it. And therefore a breathing rate for every idea you have. Now I want you to watch this very, very carefully in yourselves now, and you'll discover this is true. That every time you change your idea, your breath rate will change. I will recite the ideas, and you'll watch the breathing while you look at the idea. A green, watered swimming pool with you floating in it. A dog biting at your heel. An aeroplane gliding towards an airport. A sudden explosion when it hits a pylon. You notice what happens to you inside when you change the image?
A slight contraction in the solar plexus.
Every time you change the image, you change the image equivalent in the urge that appears in the breathing manifestation. Now you can see the importance of breath control. It means that if you want to be imperturbable, if you want a diamond body, if you want immortality, you must have that which cannot be changed. Now all temporal images change and therefore have corresponding feeling states which we call passions. That is passive, reactive levels of feeling. But there is one image which we represent in that manner, circling the cross, and the cross in the circle. And when we get that image, we have got something that stands, no matter what we think about. Now let's have a look at it. What's your breathing rate when you look at this man and this lady? Look at this. Watch the processes of association that occur in your mind. And as soon as you become aware of the breath rate that belongs to it, switch your attention to this and watch the difference. Can you state what it is now?
Deep and very shallow.
This well is deep and this is shallow? Now, that is because this one has more significance than that one, not less. When we particularize, we are apparently putting more in, we are really putting less in. The more objectified the thing is, the less there is in it. Because we are finiting the application. If we say a horse, it has wider application than if we say a white horse or a black horse. So if we widen the application, we cut off a qualifier, we'll take an adjective off horse, keep the horse, and it applies over a bigger area. So there's a possibility of a good debate here. Does white horse mean more or less than horse? The Chinese have a nice bit of scribbling in logic called, is a white horse a horse? You'll find it in the Everyman Chinese Philosophy. Worth reading, a little bit of non-Greek logic, where the concept horse is not equivalent to the concept white horse, because it is horse plus a limiting factor that is not horse. So if you go on increasing the qualifiers, supposing you put in white horse, earless, and lame in one leg, and tail cropped, for every qualifier you put on, it's becoming progressively less horse.
But more identifiable.
More particularly identifiable, and in the process it's getting weaker and weaker. And when you contemplate it, you will find that your breathing becomes agitated. So if you start enumerating the parts of an individual man, you will find yourself full of likings and dislikings for his particulars, and your breath rate will become agitated. But if you take the general concept man, your breathing will become smoother. So you see, the key to the proper rhythmical breathing that you want rests in the universal idea. In other words, the key to emotional control is in the presentation of a universal form, and if there is to be identification at all, with the universal rather than the particular. Now it's in this sort of conflict between particular and universal that the education of man proceeds in the mysteries. The ordinary man who never went into a mystical initiation didn't know what went on inside, but he knew that something went on because the man who went into it came out different. The moment he'd been in and come out again, the men who'd never been in saw a qualitative difference in him such that they considered he was elevated. He was a better man afterwards than he was before. So something went on in the mysteries to which all the people outside the mysteries attest that the man who went in wasn't so good as the man who came out from them, and that he had gained a certain control that the ordinary man had not got. And the control process was the resultant of the education in the difference between particulars and universals. So you will find Plato saying, when I refer to beauty, I do not refer to the beauty of things, which is relative and temporal, but I refer to the absolute beauty of those lines, those surfaces, volumes, which arise from the manipulation of a pair of compasses and rulers. That he called absolutely beautiful, because its beauty is not dependent on a particular. Whereas relative beauty is dependent upon particulars. A child may be born of certain parents, and the parents may be very kind and have red hair. So to the child, red hair is beautiful. But it isn't absolutely beautiful, or it cannot be evaluated so by the fact that it has been hair on the heads of men and women who have treated the child kindly, but whether it is absolutely visible or not is quite other than the effect on the emotions of the child. So that the forms precipitated by geometrical operations are absolutely beautiful, whereas the so-called beauty of a fashionable girl with a certain kind of nose or hair length and so on is relative, temporal, and not worth studying in relation to the mysteries. The mysteries shift you from the particular beauty of this lady with the knee-length skirt to the essential beauty of that circle and the cross in it, the absolute, unchangeable beauty. So when you contemplate this one, you actually find that your breath rate is different from when you contemplate this one. And as you are looking for control, you must use the means to it. And the double sound in the mi, in the mystery, the e signifies the shape of this, that it is a vertical, a horizontal, and a circle. And the u, the mu, signifies the urge that arises in you when you contemplate it. Now notice again that when I draw this vertical and the horizontal, and you put your consciousness on it, start at the top of the vertical and run down, take it off, and then put it on this side of the horizontal and then across. See if the periodicity of passing down the vertical and across the horizontal is identical. Tell me whether you take the same time to go down the vertical as you do on the horizontal. You go down on the vertical quicker. Now, that shows that you are suffering from a flat earth concept, doesn't it? A gravitational concept. Really? Now, let's posit the Earth at the centre there and say this is a circle drawn arbitrarily in outer space. Or if you like, it's the orbit of the Moon. Now, start from the bottom and run to the centre. Watch very carefully your feeling and see if you're not still imposed on by a flat Earth concept. See if it takes you the same time to run up to that centre as it does down to it. If you can't feel a drag on you when you're moving up, you can.
You can follow down, but you've got to climb up.
Now you see, that is tyranny of a concept, flat earth concept. It actually causes you, because of that concept, to take more energy to climb up there than it does to fall down there. And that shows that inside your head, as a man, you have a concept built on the theory of the flat earth, which is practically useful, but isn't true, absolutely. So that concept, when you try to climb from there to there, pinches the energy and makes it rotate through that concept first. Whereas when you start from here, you have another concept called the concept of gravity, and that one hurries the energy flow of the imagery through it. Now you see the function of the concept there. It can drag on your energy. It can delay your reaction. Or it can accelerate it. Now we're full of such conceptual beings. Those are subjects. And they actually impose on us unless we break them. Now here is a very good exercise. Deliberately put yourself on the perimeter and try to rise to that centre and up there and go to it and see if you can equalise the time. Let's try that now for a few seconds.
With an effort.
With an effort. Right, now I want you to imagine something totally different. Imagine that you are placed above this vertically and that all that is below you. In other words, you deliberately imagine that that's in this plane, the terrestrial plane. And now run in from any side. Can't you immediately do it at the same speed?
Yeah.
And doesn't that show to you that concepts have the power to steal energy from you. So you see the necessity of breaking conceptual blocks. They exist in millions of different ways, such that inside your head there are all sorts of little traps. So you may have what is called the best intention, which you heard about as a child when your educator told you to be a good boy and always to have the right intention. So you have inside that a concept called the best intention. And when an impulse arises from the tummy land down below and rises up here, when it goes near the one called the best intention, that best intention has been put into you through the ear against colossal resistance originally from your tummy energy. So the amount of energy in the best intention region is so great that your impulse cannot penetrate it. In other words, it has no effect whatever on your action. You see the mechanics of it. And the measure of the effort that your educators have used to push that concept into you is the measure of the difficulty in making it work. And you see why the real secret of education does not consist in hammering goodness into people. Because if you oppose this tummy urge down here with ideas up here against that tummy urge, you will simply set up a system there which is exactly as strong as the urge was that it had to overcome to put it in equilibrium. And therefore no urge from below will have the power to act on it. It cannot penetrate it, cannot get through it. So if ever you want to be good, I don't know what for, but if you do, you will have to penetrate that concept of good, or you will have to so break it down into fundamental truths that you have destroyed its power by spreading it over the whole system. Only then can you penetrate it. In other words, really, you have to understand the nature of the concept of the good before you can operate it. And until you do, the reciting of the word good, and be good, and so on, will have no effect. So we find a very, very old Chinese statement saying, man is told, be good, be good, be good, but nobody manages it. And that was thousands of years ago. And the Taoists said, therefore, do not say be good. Because if you say be good, and you put the concept in there, you have defined be bad. And this impulse down here doesn't like restraint of any kind. And as the one called good is the one that's socially acceptable and means inhibition of the tummy urge, when it climbs up here, the good one, it cannot penetrate to get its form from, so it goes into the bad one, which says it can do what it wants. So that the question of morality and ethics is a fundamentally mechanical one. If we now add to this our statements about breathing, we know that every time we contemplate a certain idea, our breath rate will start to harmonize with it. When we identify with it, our breath rate will be equivalent to that thing. We will be pinned upon it, and our feeling state will be a passion, that is, a passive reaction to the form defined in the idea. So if we want to transcend those little concepts in our brain, then we have to set up a bigger one. The terrestrial one, the solar one, the sidereal one, and so on. And only by setting up this bigger concept can we control the smaller ones. We have to obey something. That is, we cannot act freely and formally at the same time, because form is bondage. So if we want to act efficiently, formally, we must take a big form, bigger than the particular that we want to work on, and use the big form as a control concept in order to apply the energy on the little one. If we do the reverse and take the little concept and try to apply it universally, it will fail immediately. So suppose we take a man like Hitler. He took the big concept that the Germanic people had a separate mythology from the Italian peoples and the other so-called Christian people. And he took the big concept of the Norse myth And then he applied that to the German people. And they were the recipients of that tradition, so the concept was bigger than they were. As a governing concept to impose upon the German people. First of all, he would have found this average man knew nothing whatever about German mythology. So he would have been deprived of that master concept to begin with. And instead of that, he would have had a particular little party politic view. And if he had tried to apply it, he would have failed. So you see, when we take the two opposite cases, the little concept applied to the universal, we know it must fail. But if we take the universal one and apply it to the particular, we know it must cover it. When you get home, try looking through a magazine at all the different forms that you see in the advertisements and so on, and particularly watch your breath rate for every form you look at until you become convinced that there is a real relation between the image you consider, the image with which you identify, and the urge in you which manifests in this breath rate. The last question here is about the parts of the moon and significance. I'm going to leave it alone because although the parts of the moon are significant, they are not immediately useful to us. This naming of different makes of the moon and so on. I'll say this, that all the parts of the moon are named as sub-concepts of the meaning of the word moon. So if you take moon equals mind, and then subdivide the mind into its various departments, you will there find, from the lakes and so on the moon, the different parts of the cycle. But it isn't worth, at the moment, going into it deeply. There's another point here. Because of their secrecy in the mysteries and the initiation ceremonies, etc., is it to be believed that they had any real knowledge that could not be openly revealed? And by real knowledge, we mean magical ability which could be measured.
Misused.
Yes. Secrecy and initiation. Now, you know that the word secret and sacred are the same word. Now, I've got to be very sacred tonight in discussing this, because this question says, did they have any knowledge worthy of the name and worth keeping secret which could be misused? Now, let's look at it. Here is a word we're all familiar with, secret. Here is another word, sacred. And we're all familiar with that. This one has an ecclesiastical ring about it, and that one not. That one is more like the state and politics, and this is like the church. They are the two names for a reality which lies behind the power of the state and the power of the church. The secret is sacred, the sacred is secret. Now, in your physiological studies, you will find another word, the sacrum. All these words are puns on a fundamental euphemism. The center of power in the human body is euphemistically referred to in those three words. If we put the three-part man down, then he keeps his secrets in his head, he keeps his sacred in his heart, and his sacrum down here. Now you know that the nervous distribution of energies down here and that part of the spine that inserts energies into the sexual department is all closely connected with the significance of that word sacrum. The sac here is exactly the same sack, and it means a sack, a bag. And this room here has the significance of differentiating substance. It has to do with sexuality, with eggs, with ova and sperms. The sacrum energies are related to the genetic forces, and they are the secret of magic. They are the secret of will. You alter the whole volitional structure of a being if you deprive it of sexuality, because you have deprived it of a certain kind of form, which is a concept, which is physiologically the vehicle of the universal purpose. The universal purpose has posited form into organisms. That form is in the sperms and the ova, which have sperms on one side of their tree. So there is form as packets of power resident in the sacral regions. And the church calls it the red sack. Now you know the red dragon of the Revelations, the desire nature, the epitome of the Greeks. And as far as the intellect is concerned, you can see the same sound shifts here, the law sack. The secrets of the law. Now if you all read Troilus and Cressida, Act 1, Scene 3, about the universal wolf, you will remember that there is only one absolute power which appears in individual vehicles on earth and works through the vehicles according to the responsiveness, the sensitivity, the organization of the vehicles. And wherever the vehicle is more sensitive, the universal force will work through it more efficiently. So it is said God is no respecter of persons, he always prefers the best. And the Tower says God has no favourites, he prefers the best. You notice that, there's no favourites, he prefers the best. If he had a favourite, it wouldn't matter if that one was no good. He'd still like it, like a mother likes her favourite child when it may be the worst. And God isn't like that, Spirit isn't like that. Spirit has no favourites, it always prefers the best. So if your vehicle is any good, Spirit will use it. If you work with your ability, with your power and your form, to improve your vehicle, you necessarily make that through which the absolute force will deliberately try to come, because you are fulfilling its purpose. Because you are perfect in the instrument that it needs for its expression at the finite end. Now all that is contained in the sacred secret sacrum reference. You see here the sacrum and this word moor here, the wall, really, the French. The wall, the law, and the door. Joke. Every human being has come through the pelvic door, and he has been inserted through the pelvic door. And every energy that goes into a finite situation becomes involved in will after being locked up for a sufficient length of time, will gain the form through the rotation within the limitation, and will then evolve, it will will out. So the secret of life is in, out. And in that glyph, the sacred secret of the sacrum is hidden. For ejaculation of power at any level, there must be a driving in, and then it shoots out. If I want to hit somebody with my fist very hard, first of all, I must drive into me a concept that this person needs hitting. Then I must define he needs hitting, that's me. And then I must take my urge, my moo, and I must apply it to make me out of it. And when I have adequately defined him as worthy of being soft, and then I exalt my will on it by deliberately driving into it, he needs it. This is what they do very often in businesses when they think about the boss, which precipitates what they call industrial accidents. Getting at the boss. Define him as worthy of retribution, and then exalt the will by dwelling on it as you're grinding away, and when you've packed it enough, it comes out bang. And the measure of that bang is exactly the measure of the clarity of the definition and the importation of the will into it. So if we take a man on a plane and he wishes to change that plane for another plane, he defines the plane he's on, driving it more and more to a generic concept in the centre, till he gets the seed, and then it shoots. And then, when it's shot up, it makes another plane. And if he defines himself in again, to the seed, it will shoot onto another plane. Now that is the way that the intellectual life has been grown out of the emotional life, out of the urge life. The urge life has pressed in and made for itself a material body. Therefore St. Paul says first a physical body. Then it packs into that physical body all the experiential energies it can until it's so packed that something must happen. What happens is it shoots up and polarizes as liking and disliking. Then the liking and dislikings go to a limit, you force them back, and if you consider your likings and dislikings properly, and drive yourself onto them as centers, it floats up into the true rational life. And that is your three-level man. It can float beyond those levels by further effort. But that is the way they're generated. So our simple little glyph is the key to transcendence of all planes. And that is the meaning of the mysteries and of the secrets. And we can then answer the other part of the question, were they dangerous? Is there any danger involved? And we will say immediately there is a real danger.
Yes, sir. No.
It is become a secret. You can see why it cannot be openly revealed. If we make the true statement to people that in the lower part of their body there is an energy center which, if they contemplate properly, they will discover the source of life and the power to dominate, then their attentions will go to where they already go. But they will not concentrate them, they will drift. And then all that will happen with them is an increase of sexual activity. So that it actually causes the premature release of the information, causes a fall of those people deeper. They're not yet at the level where they have sufficient conceptual opposition to balance the urge force on the feeling level. They cannot change their phase unless they can inhibit it. So if they haven't the power to control their reactions of it, they cannot change onto the higher level. And if you tell them prematurely, before the law of substance is in them, they must continuously leak out and degenerate. So it isn't a question of keeping power from people because of jealousy on the part of the power hungers at the top. It's the fact that premature revelation causes degeneration. They must abuse it. All power that you are made aware of, for which you have no correspondent concept to balance it, will leak and you will degenerate. For which reason you shouldn't want to know the secret behind the secret until you have absorbed the meaning of the secret you've already got and deliberately applied it on the levels that you already know that. Now let's just repeat a bit about this identification. When you take consciousness, which is represented by the white paper, and make no mark upon it, there is no identification. There is no trouble. There is nothing positive, nothing posited to make trouble possible. So if we have pure consciousness with no object, there is no identification and no trouble. Now, we know that the world exists as an objective actuality, and therefore we know that an object has a function. When the Bible says God so loved the world, it means that the world has a function to absolute power, absolute intelligence. We have to find out what that real function is. The absolute intelligence has made the world as an object. And it has made that world as an object. I think we'll have a little bit more time. We'll have to restate the necessity for the object. Supposing we had the white paper extended infinitely. It is a potential of knowledge, but not an actuality, because there is no object. So it sets up for itself a sphere. Now all the motions of spirit outside that sphere, which were hazy mazy, hitting on that rim, which is caused by rotation, reacts back from the rim. So there is a modification produced by the object. That's the first. So if we represent this by A here, then the macrocosmic one is the H. That's the Aleph, and this is the H. If the absolute here hasn't got a reflection point to turn back its own motions into it, it cannot know itself. But if it has a point of reaction, it can know itself. And it can know itself in different ways according to the different character of the objects precipitated. So when it has made one of those, which is a ball, a ball, ball, all, or universal volition, it precipitates within itself another one. And then the energy of the absolute is hitting back here into the absolute, making the absolute conscious of its object. The universal is vibrating and hitting inside here. We'll say this is the sidereal one for the moment. The sidereal forces in that sphere hit on the solar forces here. And they're reflected back and produce universal consciousness. And the solar energies hit on a planet, say like the Earth, and return to the solar limit, producing solar consciousness. Now you can see what happens. We have a gross material body here, and we have this solar field and a sidereal field. Now if we take our three-part man, then that black body there corresponds with your belly land. Here is the land above, and here is the land above that. So we have three levels. That which absorbs the material, the tummy land. That where the solar plexus dominates. And that where the sidereal forces dominate, which produce ideas in the mind. So we need a point of reaction, an object which can return every kind of frequency we have. So if we want to understand that we exist physically, we must have a physical object to hit against to get a reaction. So if I strike against this chair, that it resists me allows me to know I have a physical hand. If the chair suddenly vaporized when I struck at it, my hand would go through the space where it had been, I would get no reaction, and I would not know the possibilities of my hand. So in order to know my physical possibilities, I must have a physical body to push against. Now this has to do with the sacrum yoke again, because this push at the physical end must have an anti-push whereby it can become conscious of itself. Now, in the same way, at the level of liking and disliking, I must find an emotional being, a being to whom I can emote, and who will respond emotionally. Otherwise, I can never find out my emotional capacities. And then at the rational level, I must find a man who has a rational mind such that he can react at the rational level that I put out to return the rational statement to me. Otherwise, I cannot know my rational capacity. And three levels, there are other levels, but if you don't find your reaction points at those levels and exhaust them, you can't find the other levels that exist. So you need a physical being for a physical self-awareness, an emotional being for your emotional self-awareness, and a rational being for your rational self-awareness. And if you don't find them, you cannot evolve. That means that a person who wants to evolve has actually got to go out, either physically or magically, he's got to go out and find for himself another being that can reciprocate. At the physical level, and when he's finished with that, the emotional level, when he's finished with that, the rational level, when he's finished with that, coordination level, and so on. If you don't do them separately, you cannot do them altogether. Because you have to become conscious of the physical, the emotional, and the rational separately before you can coordinate them and use them simultaneously in an act, rational, emotional, and physical, simultaneously, for which you need a reciprocating being able to function at those three levels. Suppose we take a man and he is a man interested in physical sense experience only. So he goes out and he looks for a girl who is at the same level, called an enthusiastic amateur. Now he finds her and he gets a physical satisfaction and he says farewell, and she says farewell, and they go away and they don't even know when to see each other again, because it might not be the same kind of situation. And in such a kind, there's no rationality. There is immediacy of energy expenditure and then departure until it builds up again. Next time it may be in the skating rink, and the time after that in the plant. It doesn't matter at that level. And supposing after a certain amount of experience of that kind, he finds a need for an emotional relation, and he meets the same girl again. And she says, oh, don't be soppy. See, she hasn't got that which he needs for an emotional reflection. So he has to go away and find one that can respond emotionally. And when he finds one of those, he's got to go and find one that can respond rationally as well. If he doesn't, he's going to be disappointed, because his evolution is going to be suspended until he finds one. So you can see that when we're discussing this sort of thing, that it really is surcharged with significances that make it potentially dangerous for an unprepared person. A person that's done no mental work could quite easily be triggered off, stampeded into all sorts of extravagant behaviour, which for them could only spell trouble. Not that there's anything immoral or unethical in the kinds of relation they might get into, but that they would not be able to pay the price that they would be required to pay for energy expenditure not controlled by them. Remember, nothing is permissible in the evolutionary path except that which is done by act of will deliberately. Reaction, mechanical, is not allowed, because you cannot evolve mechanically. You must do everything deliberately. The physical level, the emotional level, the rational level, all must be made conscious and deliberate. Otherwise it doesn't count for evolution. And for it to be conscious, you must have a conscious reciprocal point on which to act, and which will act back on you. Now, is that clear? Have we any questions about this relation? It's all to do with this breathing, this impulse, expulse of energy, the form onto which you contract, which is an idea, the degree of urge power you put into the contraction, which is the degree of the expression afterwards, the linkage of the individual rhythm with solar, sidereal rhythms and so on, they're all fundamentally tied together so closely that you cannot legitimately think about one of those problems without being driven to consider all. To consider identification, you have to consider that which identifies and that with which it is identified. The subject and the object. The subjective world of pure contracted actuality. So that to try to consider one forces you to consider all.
I would like to ask you a question about this awareness with regards to situations. For instance, you can decide that you're going to say something or do something in order to observe your own reaction. On other occasions, you can find that suddenly you become aware yourself of how you have reacted to something that has started. The one has started off being mechanical and suddenly you have become aware of it, and the other you have entered into it aware of what you were going to do. Now, is there any value in the other one where you have started off mechanically and suddenly become aware?
Well, let's look at the two processes a moment. There's your head, there's an ear, one will do, drilling a concept into it. We drill a concept into the ear and it goes up here and it turns around. Now, in a baby, there is no concept of reflexive self-consciousness. When we drill such a concept into the ear of a human being, and the concept takes up its place in the brain, is ingrained there, and says reflexive self-consciousness, it is just a form put in through the ear. It has no immediate relation with the urge department down here or the feeling department. When you first say reflexive self-consciousness to an average man, it does not produce profound reactions in the second. It doesn't produce great effluxes of emotion. It just goes reflexive self-consciousness. And it has no meaning. It's just a form. So it's put inside. But then, the word reflex is in it. Bending back. And that word, bending back, is written somewhere in his Saxon brain. You see? And gradually, the resonances of this concept go through, and they strike on the backbending concept over here. And then suddenly, he begins to think reflexive self-consciousness might be interesting. And he doesn't know it, but he's seen a funny image, something like this. You see? A backbending image. Simply because of the associations of reflex. Now, he, at the fundamental terminal level, then suffers, because he doesn't do it deliberately, the resonance relation of the two concepts. And reflexive self-consciousness then begins to glow because it offers to the urge possibilities of fulfillment of backbending operations. It's as simple as that, mechanically. So then, incline thine ear, it says, to further information about reflexive self-consciousness. Now, self is a word that we're all fond of, and that's engrammed over the whole brain. So we like the self part of it, and we like certain interpretations of the backbending part of it, and the consciousness, the simple awareness, we are vaguely aware of what it means. So we have a very vague one in the consciousness, a very vague resonance, a sharp one in the self one, and one that was not seen through in its significances when first inserted in reflex. But as these resonances begin to make their connections with other definitions, conceptual structures in the mind, So the whole process begins to integrate itself. But initially, it integrates itself only insofar as it appears to subserve the purposes of JT below. And that must be so. Because the sacred part is down here. And the only reason for inclining thine ear to the secret, to the primary urge, is to increase its actual performance. So initially, all the ideas that people get about truth and goodness and beauty, they're all interpreted by this department as meaning more of what I like. And that necessarily so. Then, as you work upon it, you become aware of other planes, because in the process of working upon this, the energy from below, believing this system to offer it fulfillment, begins to pile energy into it. And then quite suddenly, the pile of energy into this changes its phase. When the integration of the concepts inside the mind imported through the five senses reaches a certain level, quite suddenly, instead of being particular, it becomes universal. And then it is realized that every other being is evolving in the same way. Then arises the idea that not every being will do, because you must have a reciprocal center in the being for every center you wish to develop. That means you need a three-center being, a human being, if you want a full human development. Some fellows who have been happy to develop on two levels. In the Middle East, a lot of them are happy on two levels. If you want the full human relationship, you will have to find the being with all the different levels. So when we find that a declaration has been made, I will be reflexive self-conscious, it means that the original concept set up by rattling of the ear has dominated consciousness for a time. But we know that it has done so originally because the urge chappy from below thinks it's a good idea. So when the idea comes, I will watch and I will be wakeful and I will be reflectively self-conscious, is declared, immediately this fellow says, most certainly do, watch. And then the eyes start staring out. They stare out into the world. They are watching. And what they're watching for is that which will please the fellow below. So the next moment, the concept has lapsed, and you become unconscious again. And you fall into the experience. And the more involved you become in the external experience, the more finite your power becomes, until you're driven logically and inevitably to the point where you fail in the external world. You are then unconscious. But at the point of failure, there's a little concept to do with failure here, and it has an immediate link with the reflexive self-consciousness concept, which has been defined as the way out of failure. So the moment you have reached failure level, a certain amount of energy flies into the failure department, and the only connection between the failure department is the one how to avoid failure, namely the master concept of reflexive self-consciousness. So out of the depth of your unconsciousness, you suddenly wake up. Now the processes are exactly equal. One is not better than the other, because they're both mechanical. The one that rattled your eardrum and set the concept in, that made the declaration, you didn't make it, it made itself once it was established, and the resonance with the purposes of the tummy gentleman below, which caused the extraversion, which causes the lapse of reflexive consciousness, and the final failure in the external world, which triggered off the failure concept and re-establishes the connection with the reflection concept, all are mechanical. So you have to see the whole cycle of it and set up another observer outside the physical body to watch the whole process. And it is this one outside the body that you have to become. You really are that. You become what you are. You have to continuously re-become that observer and watch these mechanical processes. So when wakefulness occurs, you see it. That is a stimulus response of a conceptual being. And after a time it will lapse, and you're watching it lapse. You actually see this fellow below say, jolly good idea then. Send up a message that I am extrovert and you are watching. And you keep watching while they're extroverting. You don't interfere with them and stop them extroverting. Initially, you just watch them do it to become convinced of the mechanics of the process. And you continuously backflow to the non-formal consciousness. And then when you've seen the whole process and the pure mechanicality of so-called salvation and, what do they call it, perdition, when you see the mechanicalness of both processes and you continuously backflow, you escape from the mechanicality of perdition and salvation. So you see they're exactly equal and opposite. That's the real saviour, the non-formulated consciousness, which you must continuously re-become with the formula, the observer is not the observer.